Good evening. This is Life Rattle, your story show, and I'm your host, Virginia Ashbery. Tonight, Life Rattle number 1173 features stories by Life Rattle writer Jeff Fitzpatrick. Jeff Fitzpatrick, tonight's writer, was born in Toronto, the younger of two boys, in 1975. The Fitzpatrick family moved to Brampton when Jeff was five, and he grew up and went to school there. He took a year off his computer science studies at university to work in the IT department of a large company before resuming his formal education, then graduating in 2001. Jeff went on to work documenting software for a nuclear engineer. Jeff Fitzpatrick's stories tonight highlight the fragility and awkward self-consciousness of youth. Fitzpatrick's direct, immediate style of short sentences and lots of detail reflects the curiosity of the narrator. So let's listen now as Jeff Fitzpatrick reads his first story tonight on Life Rattle.
Janice by Jeff Fitzpatrick. Friday, February 7, 1997, noon. 1 week before Valentine's Day. I sit at the campus pub, my classes finished for the week. I've never gone to the pub before. I've come with my friend Janice, along with several of her friends. We often eat together in the cafeteria. Today, we eat at the pub. I dislike pubs. Pubs produce too much smoke, too much alcohol, too much fried meat. I don't smoke, drink alcohol, or eat meat. I'm a vegetarian. Janice is not. I came to the pub to talk to Janice about something. I read the menu but decide not to eat. I don't want greasy fries. I should have brought my lunch. I play some games. I like air hockey, though I lose most of the time. The first person to score 7 goals wins. I lack hand-eye coordination. After lunch, Janice leaves. I want to stop her, but I lack courage. Janice has a 3-hour biology lab until 5 o'clock. I consider waiting for her, but I don't know where her class is. I watch Janice walk to the main building, wishing I wasn't a coward. On the bus ride home, I resolve to phone Janice on Saturday. I cannot keep this inside any longer. Valentine's Day comes next Friday. Saturday, February 8, 1997, 10 o'clock. I get up. I know I have to call Janice, but I wait. I don't want to call her too early. I think about what I will say to Janice on the phone. I feel anxious and queasy. I have never done this before. Maybe I should wait. But I hate waiting. I'll feel better after I talk to Janice. At least, I hope so. I feel too jumpy to eat anything. I watch an old rerun of The Wonder Years. The episode ends with Kevin and Winnie together on Valentine's Day. Winnie tells Kevin she likes him. After the show, I turn the TV off and go upstairs. I don't have a phone, so I have to use my parents' room. My mother works downstairs in the kitchen. My older brother is around somewhere. My father went to work. I go to my room to get Janice's number. Then I walk slowly to my parents' room, almost tiptoeing. I close the door. I want nobody to hear me. I pick up the fax phone and listen to the dial tone. I worry about the other phones in the house. What if somebody overhears my conversation, I wonder? What if my brother does? I dial the number. After the first 6 digits, I pause. I gather courage. I press the last digit firmly and inhale. The phone rings on Janice's end. After the second ring, Janice answers it. Hello? Hi, Janice, it's Jeff. Is this a bad time? Not at all, I just got back from Tremendous. Janice eats at Tremendous every Saturday. I wanted to talk to you about something, I stammer. What's up? I tell Janice that I like her, that I have feelings for her, that I have a crush on her. Jana says nothing. I want to say more, but I don't know what else to say. My heart sinks into my chest. I'm not really good at expressing my feelings, I admit. I wait. Well, I'm glad that you decided to share your feelings with me, Jeff, she starts. Jana sounds surprised by my admission. My heart sinks further. I'm doomed. It takes a lot of courage to say what you said, she continues, especially when you don't know how the other person will react. Yes, I say. I want to find a quiet corner somewhere and die. Unfortunately, I don't feel the same way about you. I mean, I like being your friend and all, and spending time with you. But I cannot see us ever being more than friends. Do you understand what I'm saying? I do. Yes, thanks for listening. I guess I'll see you next week. On Monday, she says. Goodbye, Jeff. Bye. I hang up. After my days of indecision and cowardice, this took only a few minutes. I cross the room to the door as quietly as I came in. When I get to my room, I sit at my desk. I look down at Janice's number. I look away. I stare at my clothes, books, and textbooks. That didn't go so well, I think. I think about the call all weekend. I have trouble eating. My mother asks questions, but I deflect them. I cannot talk about this. Not now. Probably not ever. Mostly, I worry about meeting Janice on Monday. What will I say to Janice? What will Janice say to me? Will we remain friends? I come up with no answers. Monday, February 10, 1997, 9:30. I get to school. Janice waits by the woman's washroom. I walk up to her. Hey, Jeff. Hi. How was your weekend? It was okay, I guess. How did she think my weekend went? I've got something for you, she says. Janice smiles, exposing big white teeth. I've always liked Janice's smile. Janice bends down, opens her school bag, and removes a white envelope with my name scribbled in pen on the outside. I take the envelope from her. Will I see you at lunch? She asks. Sure. I bend down and put the envelope in my school bag. I tell Janice thanks and walk down the hall. After class, I climb the stairs to the second floor of the library. I find a quiet carol. I take the envelope out of my bag and put it on the desk. After a few seconds, I open the envelope and remove a letter written on yellow-lined paper. I unfold the letter and read. The top left corner of the first page contains a sticker, a sun on top of clouds. The last page contains another sticker. A kid holds a balloon. His hands rise above his head and out to the side. The balloon contains a caption. It says, "You did a great job." The third page contains a poem entitled Risk that Janice got at a leadership conference in grade 11. I read the following lines of the poem over and over. To expose feelings is to risk exposing your true self. To love is to risk not being loved in return. To try is to risk failure. I put my head down on the desk and close my eyes.
That was Jeff Fitzpatrick reading his story, Janice. Fitzpatrick's next story is called Three Stitches and a Tetanus Shot. Let's hear that one now.
Three Stitches and a Tetanus Shot by Jeff Fitzpatrick. I worked as a dishwasher at a mall restaurant and bar called Ricky Joe's for 2.5 years. After washing dishes for 8 hours, I went home reeking of fried food, beer, and cigarette smoke. I earned $6.85 an hour. On day shifts, I helped open the restaurant. The restaurant opened at 11 o'clock a.m. Day shifts began at 9 o'clock a.m. For 2 hours, I swept and mopped the dance floor, the bar area, the entrance, and both washrooms. I carried patio furniture out to the brick patio and helped set up the tables and chairs on the dance floor. In the washrooms, I wiped the counters and mirrors and scrubbed the toilets and urinals with a brush. Wiping the mirrors with a wet paper towel, followed by a dry paper towel, prevented streaks. In the kitchen, I unrolled the black mats. 3 mats covered the floor of the dishwashing area. A long mat covered the floor in front of the line where the cooks prepared the orders. I set up the garbage can, recycle bin, and the food waste bin. I washed the dirty dishes from the previous night. I filled 2 bins with water and chemicals used to soak the cutlery and the coffee cups. I returned all the glasses to the bar, and all the plates and bowls and ashtrays to the cupboards. I washed all the prep dishes and waited for the orders to ring in and the dirty dishes to come back. On slow days, I left early. Dirty dishes piled up for the night shift. The night shift began at 5 o'clock p.m. On night shifts, I helped close the restaurant. I washed the cutlery, coffee cups, and ashtrays a final time. I returned all the clean dishes to their rightful spots. I carried trays of glasses to the bar. I wiped the counters, cleaned the sinks, rolled the mats, and swept and mopped the kitchen. I carried trays of coffee cups to the front beside the coffee machine. I dumped the water from the mop bucket, got the manager to sign my timesheet, and waited for my father to pick me up. One time in the summer, I worked a Saturday night. Another dishwasher asked me to cover his shift for him. That Saturday, after midnight, I rolled up the mats early and dragged them into the kitchen closet. The line had closed for the night. As usual, the mats were filthy. Dirt covered my hands and stuck under my fingernails. I scrubbed my hands with soap and water. During my shift, I washed my hands constantly. I took the piles of dirty black glass ashtrays and lined them in a dishwasher tray. I sprayed the ashtrays and turned my head as black soot hung in the air around me. I shoved the ashtrays into the dishwasher and pulled down the top. After 3 cycles, steam assaulted me as I pulled out the ashtrays. When the ashtrays cooled, I stacked them into 3 piles and returned them to their cupboard. It took 3 trips to put away a tray of ashtrays. Each trip I carried 1 pile, my left hand cupped underneath the ashtray on the bottom, my right hand cupped over the ashtray at the top. Carrying the ashtrays, I walked to the cupboard slowly, deliberately, and carefully. I used the same technique when carrying trays of glasses to the bar. As I carried the 3rd pile of ashtrays to the cupboard, I slipped and fell on the wet floor. I should have let go of the ashtrays and let them fall to the floor. I should have returned the ashtrays before rolling up the mats and mopping the floor. 2 mistakes. Ashtrays hit the ground. Glass shattered, skin broke, and blood splattered. I looked at my hands. Blood gushed from my thumb and index finger of my left hand. My right hand had avoided the glass. Blood stained the floor and the steel cabinets near the dessert fridge. I had never seen so much blood before. Dave, a burly manager, came into the kitchen. He looked at me sprawled on the floor. He looked at the broken and unbroken ashtrays scattered around me. He looked at the blood gushing from my left hand. Dave brought me to the nearest sink, turned on the faucet, and ran cold water over my left hand. Blood flowed down the drain. "Keep your hand in the water," Dave said. "Otherwise, your hand will get infected." I kept my hand in the water. Blood continued to flow down the drain. I looked away from the sink and wondered how much blood I had lost. What if I lose too much blood? I wondered. Then I felt dizzy. I swayed and started to fall. Whoa, Dave said. Easy does it. Dave held me and kept me from falling. After a few seconds, the dizziness passed. Dave turned the water off and crudely bandaged my hand. A small crowd of servers and the bartender had gathered around. Are you okay? Dave asked. Yeah, I'm all right. I straightened up. I'll get someone to call your parents, Dave said. You need to go to the hospital. You'll probably need stitches. My father took me to emergency at Peel Memorial Hospital in Brampton. I showed off my hand to the nurse and the doctor. The doctor gave me 3 stitches and a tetanus shot and sent me home.
That was Jeff Fitzpatrick reading his story, 3 Stitches and a Tetanus Shot. The final story we're going to hear tonight from Fitzpatrick is called Going to My Brother's House. Let's listen to that one now.
Going to My Brother's House by Jeff Fitzpatrick. Jeff, it's time to go to your brother's house, my mother yells from downstairs. I lift my head from the Human Computer Interaction textbook. I look at my alarm clock. It reads 4:02 p.m. Wearily, I get up from my desk chair and head to the door. Your father is at the front door grinding his teeth, my mother yells. I shut my room door behind me and jog down the 2 sets of stairs to the first floor. When I get to the hallway, my mother stands by the front door. Where's your father? My mom asks. Now we're ready, and he's not. I'm here, my father replies, from the living room, wearing his coat. I put on my shoes and coat and follow my parents outside. Lincoln, our Labrador retriever, watches us from the dining room, his head resting on his front paws. It's the first Thanksgiving since my older brother moved out of the house. Mike moved in May and got married in July. Mike and his wife Carrie invited us to their new house in Mississauga for Thanksgiving dinner. They also invited Carrie's mother, Carrie's brother, and his wife. I haven't got along with my brother in years. One time, when I was about 12, he threw a Dudley lock at my head. We were in the backyard of our old house. My friends from the neighborhood, John Paul, Kent, Tony, and Chris were also there. The lock connected. I remember the blood flowing from my head, and my brother spraying my head with the hose. I remember going inside to complain to my mother. She was talking to my grandmother on the phone and thought I was joking. At 28, Mike is 4 years older than me. Things have gotten better since he moved out. We don't ignore each other as much. We say hello and goodbye. We talk on the phone, sometimes. I guess seeing each other less frequently helps. Now we act civil. Mostly. I sit in the back seat of my parents' car beside a green plant wrapped in plastic. My mother sits in front of me, in the passenger seat. My father sits behind the wheel. What is this plant doing beside me? I ask, as we head to the highway. It's a gift for Mike and Carrie, my mother replies. Why are we giving a gift? I mean, wasn't a gift for the shower and the wedding and the rehearsal dinner enough? Do we have to give a gift for everything? It's customary to give a gift when you're going to someone else's house, my mother informs me, especially when they are providing you dinner. I would have got candy, but Carrie's on a diet. What's wrong with giving a gift? My father asks me. Nothing, I guess. It just seems odd. Why is the car in front of us going so slow? My father says. We slow down. My heart quickens, and I feel tense. Unhappy drivers make me nervous. Cars jam the highway. Probably because the cars in front of him are going slow, my mother answers. I dislike cars. I did try to get my driver's license once, but I realized later that I didn't want to drive. Driving causes stress. Drivers rush everywhere. I avoid cars whenever possible. I haven't rode in a car since my brother's wedding. See, I'm not the only one who doesn't like to drive, I say. Even drivers don't seem to like it. They're always in a hurry. My parents say nothing. We have talked about this before. Eventually, the traffic clears and we speed up. I relax. I should have taken a bus to their house, I mutter. How far is my brother's house from Derry and here, Ontario? Oh, quite a ways, my father says. A few miles, at least. I've never seen a Derry bus before, my mother says, but that doesn't mean there isn't one. You mean you've never been to Mike and Carrie's house before? My father asks me. That's right, I say. I had managed to avoid it until now. Really? Yeah. It's his virgin trip to his brother's house, my mother says. Well, I hope it's as good for them as it is for me, I reply. Mike and Carrie live on Belshire Gate, a new neighborhood. Their house faces a mud field. Beyond the field stand a few trees. My father parks on the side of the road against the field. I open the car door and get out. I evade the mud. Why don't you take something? My mother suggests. I end up with a bottle of ice wine and the rolls. My father carries the plant. This dinner means a lot to my mom. My mother rings the doorbell. On the other side of the door stand four stacks of hay. A small pumpkin tops each stack. Corn husks cover the pillars of the porch. Sunflowers and straw hang from the front door. Carrie opens the door wide. Hello, she says. Come on in. As we enter the house, Carrie takes the wine and rolls from me and gives them to her mother. They gave me the wine for some reason, I say. Carrie laughs. She knows I don't drink. We remove our shoes. My mother removes her coat and hangs it in the hallway closet. I do the same. Well, hello, says Carrie's mother. I didn't expect you guys so soon. Linda, I didn't think you were getting off work until 5 or 5:30. From behind the closet, I glare at my mother. My mother stares at Carrie's mother, smiling. Damn, we could have left over an hour later. But I keep this thought to myself as I join the in-laws watching television in the living room. We watch the Winnipeg Blue Bombers and the BC Lions each score 3 touchdowns in the fourth quarter. The Blue Bombers beat the Lions 40-33. After the game, we sit down to eat the Thanksgiving feast. Everyone eats turkey but me. I eat stir-fried vegetables over rice.
That was Going to My Brother's House, written and read by Jeff Fitzpatrick. And that concludes Life Rattle number 1173. Arnie Ackman recorded Fitzpatrick reading his stories. My name is Virginia Ashbery. And Life Rattle returns next Sunday night at 9 o'clock with more stories. Life Rattle is produced from Toronto, Ontario, Canada, and was created by Guy Allen and Arnie Ackman.